we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices, Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, October 18th, 2019. I'm your host, Elise Jacobson, and I'm joined here in the studio today by my co-host, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
And our control room operator, Carol Davies McIntosh.
Hi, everybody.
Today's show features a special extended interview with writer and decolonial theorist Af Coe. Her new book, Racism as Zoological Witchcraft, A Guide to Getting Out, was just published earlier this month. She'll be speaking with us about her theory of how systemic violence toward animals is a manifestation of white supremacy. She has very thought-provoking insights to share on this, so stay tuned. That's coming up in about 20 minutes. Today is also a special day here on Co-op Radio because it's the start of our annual fall member drive. Vancouver Co-op Radio has been bringing listeners quality, locally produced programming for nearly 45 years. All of our programs are produced by volunteers, and we are one of the few non-commercial radio stations around. Co-op Radio and our show, Animal Voices, rely on listeners like you to keep us on the air so we can continue to bring you informative, compelling community radio programming each and every week. So, how can you help? Well, you can support us by becoming a member of Co-op Radio or a monthly sustainer. You can do this online at co-opradio.org/donate or over the phone at 604-684-8494. You can also send a check to Vancouver Co-op Radio, 370 Columbia Street, Vancouver, BC, V6A4J1, or stop by the station to drop off your donation in person or fill out a membership form. So please go online or call today to get your monthly donation set up. Again, that's co-opradio.org/donate. A donation of even $10 a month goes a long way toward keeping your local independent radio station and Western Canada's only animal rights radio program on the air. We are so grateful for your support. And now I just wanted to briefly discuss a little piece of news that has been circulating this week. We touched on this a couple weeks ago on the show in news. A group of prominent scientists, including David Suzuki, signed an open letter to mayors around the world calling on them to slash meat and dairy consumption in their cities. And this month, mayors from 14 major cities worldwide answered that call and committed to slashing the amount of meat and dairy consumed by their constituents as part of the C40 Cities Climate Leadership Group's initiative to mitigate the climate crisis. Mayors from Barcelona, Copenhagen, Guadalajara, Lima, London, Los Angeles, Milan, Oslo, Paris, Quezon City, Seoul, Stockholm, Tokyo, and Toronto all signed a declaration to become, quote, good food cities by implementing policies that align with the planetary health diet by 2030. The commitment includes a pledge to reduce the procurement of meat products to 300 grams per person per week. That's about 10.6 ounces or about two burger patties. Greenpeace has praised this decision on the part of the mayors. Again, that demand letter was signed by 65 prominent scientists, so it was pretty kind of a big deal. One thing that kind of stuck out to me, though, is that Vancouver is not on that list. I wondered about that. What do you think about that, Sinead?
Yeah, well, Vancouver was the first city in Canada, I believe, to publicly endorse Meatless Mondays. That was back in 2013.
Yes.
To suddenly say, encouraging Meatless Mondays is one thing, but there hasn't actually been a lot of action from the city as far as encouraging plant-based diets. And so this, I mean, it doesn't really surprise me, but, you know, for a city like ours that, you know, they had this campaign going on a few years ago saying we were going to make Vancouver the greenest city by 2020, right?
Yes.
And here we are in 2019
yeah.
and still dragging our feet. And I mean, even with Meatless Mondays, I love... I'm going to read this quote from a blog. There's a blog called Eat Plants, Drink Beer.
Oh, nice.
and there's this piece that I would really recommend. It's called Do Vegans Effing Love Science?
Oh, nice.
and it describes the relationship between animal agriculture and climate change. And they talk about Meatless Mondays. And they say if we lived in a world where all our energy could be generated from wind, solar, and waves, how would you feel if almost everyone decided they were going to run a gas-guzzling generator anyway, mm-hmm. but only 6 days a week right. to power their house while you used the emissions-free energy sources for all the 7 days? Like, wouldn't you be mad if people 6 days a week were choosing the less efficient option that is compromising all of our futures?
Right.
You know? And,
right.
and so that's the thing. With Meatless Mondays and with government in general, you know, when cities like Vancouver are sort of dragging their feet,
yeah.
and going, people don't want to be told what to eat or this or that. It's like, you know, Greta Thunberg acts like your house is on fire because
exactly.
it is. So
exactly, we're getting to a point where it's not. It's going to get to a point where it's not really even a choice anymore. You know, it's that desperate. Yeah, going back to what you said about Vancouver committing to being the greenest city by 2020, that makes it extra surprising to me that they wouldn't sign on to a resolution like this to reduce meat and dairy consumption in the city, because that's such an easy way to. You know,
yeah,
make that happen. So.
Yeah, for sure. And that's another thing in this piece on that blog. You know, that saying going vegan can cut an individual's carbon footprint in half, and mm-hmm. all you have to do is eat delicious and healthy food. That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah, you know? It cuts your water footprint in half too. Yeah, a whole bunch of things.
Yeah, you know, you don't have to modify your house or buy an expensive new car. You just have to eat good food. Yeah, you know, people act like, oh, well, that's really hard. But as we've spoken about on the show on a regular basis, there are so many options out there.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody has, well, most people have access to the internet where there are countless recipes and tips. And we're in a climate crisis. So, I would encourage everybody to check it out. And,
absolutely.
And in Vancouver, we are very lucky. We have so many restaurants.
Yes.
Plant-based restaurants and, lots of good stuff going on.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's amazing. It's getting easier all the time. Yeah, I would urge listeners to contact the mayor of Vancouver, the mayor's office, and all lawmakers maybe... ask them about all of this, why they refused to sign on to this resolution. Maybe see if we can get some answers on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also in the news this week, there were a few stories actually that I heard about that stuck out to me. Things just on CBC and you know, just more mainstream news sources that have been talking about animals being rescued. One was a little pig named Mango.
Aww.
Who has found his forever home at an animal sanctuary east of Ottawa after he was found at the side of the highway with a broken leg, and he must have fallen out of a truck or something that happens on the way to the slaughterhouse. They're all packed in these vehicles. But anyway, so this little guy was rescued and he's now at a sanctuary, and there's this big story about it, and people are fawning over this really adorable little pig named Mango. And so there was that one. And then there was also this one about a Scottish farmer who drove 442 kilometers to rescue a lamb that she sold for meat.
Wow.
And so she was raising sheep. She'd sent all the lambs to slaughter, but she couldn't stop thinking about this one who was sort of the runt of the litter, you know, and so she was helping him to... He was, helping him get healthy again, and she wound up spending more time with this little lamb, and she felt really bad about sending him to be killed for profit, right?
Wow.
And it was really cool to hear that story. You know, it's great, but there's a tone to these things that I appreciate having the opportunity to address on our radio show. And yeah, Co-op Radio, you know, not the mainstream news sources. We can talk about these things. These things where they're talking, yeah, you know, you can talk about this one animal that she had a connection with, and she says, you know, I was just so attached to him. He wasn't like the rest of the lambs. He was more like a dog.
Wow.
And so when I sold him, it was like selling my dog. And the thing is that all lambs are the same as dogs in all the ways that matter, you know?
Like, I was going to say, so close to getting it there. So close.
Yeah, exactly, you know? And you're just going, so really, I mean, you made a connection with this one individual, but they are all individuals.
Yeah.
And so, just anybody who hears these stories, I would just encourage everyone to remember that any one of those lambs or pigs, or you know, the nice happy rescue stories, they're nice to hear, but remember that there are billions of other individuals who want to live just as much, and they, you know, if you ask anybody, do you believe in killing for something you don't need to survive, you know, would you kill an animal for something you didn't need, most people are inclined to say no, but the reality is most people eat meat and dairy and eggs, and these are industries that are based on killing for profit.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And as we mentioned, there are other options. So
it's an interesting psychological phenomenon, you know, among humans. I think this has been studied a lot too, where we connect a lot more with individuals. You know, if we hear about a tragedy that's happening to billions of animals, or even billions or millions of people, it doesn't resonate as much as, you know, connecting with a single individual. So, you know, that's just something to keep in mind. I think these rescue stories are great to just sort of bring that to light, you know, like you're spotlighting an individual, but like you said, we do have to remember that this is happening on a massive scale, and like you said, they're all individuals, they all have their own personalities, and you know, they all want to live. None of them is necessarily more special than any other one.
Absolutely. Another piece of nice news this week, there is a new non-animal testing lab in Windsor, and it is the first of its kind in Canada, and so human cells and tissues from cadavers are being used to produce replicas of human tissue, and that's amazing.
Yeah,
that's
great. So cool.
So the Canadian Centre for Alternatives to Animal Methods was unveiled on Thursday, and with the aim of focusing on animal safe biomedical research, and animal testing is not effective and it's dangerous. We've talked about it on the show before. If you go to our website, animalvoices.org, and just search animal testing, you will find several interviews and information on the subject.
Yeah, cool. Thank you, Sinead. So once again, as we mentioned earlier, we are just kicking off our fall member drive. Co-op Radio is so special in our Vancouver community. It's a listener-supported radio station. We've been around since 1975. All of the programming on this station is produced by volunteers, and we're one of very few non-commercial stations around. This is completely commercial-free radio. We're not beholden to any corporate sponsors, so completely free, freely produced radio. And we rely on membership from listeners like you to keep going and to stay independent. So for me personally, I've been volunteering here at Co-op Radio on Animal Voices for 5 years as a producer and 5 years as a co-host and 4 years as a producer. And it's been so important to me. I so appreciate the fact that, again, we are the only radio program in Western Canada that deals with animal rights issues, with compassionate living. And it's amazing too that we have very few limitations in terms of what we can present. We can just be completely open and share information that maybe the mainstream media is not willing to share with people. So that's extremely special to me. And obviously this show would not be able to exist without Co-op Radio. There's really no other,
you know, radio forum in this area that would allow us to present this kind of programming. So are you a member? If not, would you like to become a member? Would you like to become a monthly sustainer? If so, you can sign up to be a member. You can renew your membership or make a donation online by visiting coopradio.org/donate, or you can call 604-684-8494 to donate over the phone. So please do that right now. How about you, Sinead? How long have you been on this show again? I don't remember.
It has been 3 years now.
Nice.
It feels like it's been longer.
but
I have been a listener for longer than 3 years, so maybe that's
right.
It. And you know, Animal Voices is one of the reasons why I first became familiar with Co-op Radio. I mean, living in Vancouver and appreciating the radio was generally the thing. But yeah, Animal Voices, Rock Talk, I was listening to earlier.
Right.
Fridays on Co-op Radio are one of my favorites because you got Rock Talk and you got Jody with Sound Resistance, and then you got Animal Voices.
That's right. But, and A-Train after. I love A-Train.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's a good day. Yeah. But yeah, so I've been volunteering here for 3 years, and it has been important to me in all sorts of ways. It's been a really eye-opening thing to be a part of, to be able to just share information in the community, and mm-hmm. and then yeah, you know, you go out and talk to people. I was telling you earlier, I had a neighbor come up to me who I had never spoken to about animal rights issues at all, and you know, I just see her saw her down the road, you know, and she came up and she said, hey, you know, I love the show that you do, and I've been trying to go vegetarian for so many years, and your show is really helpful, and like, yeah, just you're sharing information with the community, and then you wind up meeting people, wind up having conversations with people and supporting each other, and I like that.
Absolutely.
That is an important thing that you can't find everywhere.
Yeah, super cool. How about you, Carol?
Well, I'm not going to say I've been here for 2 years, but it seems like longer,
right?
But I have been here for about 2 years, and it's actually gone by really fast, and it was kind of a surprise to me. It wasn't something I was looking for. I was invited by one of the other members to come and see what it was like to do. I've never even thought about doing any kind of radio. And I kind of walked in and started to do a little bit of hosting, and then I ended up taking a whole bunch of courses, and now I'm operating the boards and producing and all kinds of stuff. So it's really opened up a lot of areas for me personally.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm grateful for that. But it's also given me an appreciation for Co-op Radio, which wasn't something that I was listened to earlier, mm-hmm. before I was a member here, and the diversity that this station provides to the community is unlike, it's not like any other.
Yes.
You can't find it anywhere else. I'm a big CBC fan for a lot of the things that they do, but they still can't touch a lot of the areas that we go into here, and I think it's really worthwhile. And I would encourage people to, if you can't become a sustaining member or whatever, like, you know, shoot us $15 or something. Mm-hmm. Just whatever.
Absolutely. Any donation helps.
Whatever works.
So, yeah. So, once again, please visit coopradio.org/donate or call 604-684-8494 to set up your membership today. Again, we're so grateful for your support and we depend on it.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
Yeah.
My guest today is author and decolonial theorist Af Coe. Af is the co-author of the book Afroism, Essays on Pop Culture, Feminism, and Black Veganism from Two Sisters. She is also the founder of Black Vegans Rock. In 2019, PETA stated that Af has arguably done more to give Black vegans a voice than any other media outlet today. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, Black Youth Project, Huffington Post, and Veg News magazine, to name a few. In 2017, Af was nominated for the People Environment Achievement Award. Her second book, Racism as Zoological Witchcraft, A Guide to Getting Out, was just published this month. Hello, Af, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really excited to have this conversation. So
oh,
thank you.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you for being here. So first of all, tell us about Black Vegans Rock. What is it and what was your aim with this project?
Sure. So I launched Black Vegans Rock, which is a website, back in 2016. And I decided to make it because I was seeing these conversations pop up that were stating that veganism was this white thing, that only white people who were, you know, elitist and bougie and wealthy were engaging in this lifestyle. And I saw this conversation in multiple spaces, particularly like anti-racist spaces. And I also saw in the vegan movement that they're like, oh, this is a white thing. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to kind of curate different stories from Black people who were vegan, who wanted to share why they went vegan. And I populated it on a website. And it really just changed me as a vegan, because I read a ton of different perspectives and it really challenged some of my own. And for me, it's like a representation project. It's a project that offers visibility to Black vegans to kind of silence the critics who say veganism is white.
Amazing. So you state in your new book, Racism as Zoological Witchcraft, A Guide to Getting Out, that you yourself proudly identify as vegan, but you also express that veganism and the animal rights movement as they exist today may not be enough to bring about animal liberation. Can you elaborate on this?
Absolutely. And that's a really deep question. So I'll try my best. So for me, yeah, I identify as vegan. I am plant-based. But I have always wrestled with the term vegan because it has a particular historical legacy. And in popular culture, people have a particular idea of what a vegan does and what a vegan looks like. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really confusing term, because I actually think a lot of people have different definitions for veganism. And even on Black Vegans Rock, just within the Black community, veganism has a different connotation depending upon your life experience. So for me, while I am plant-based, I don't really at times relate to the vegan movement. And as I'm getting older and as I'm reading more outside of the movement, I'm finding that this might not be the best space even just for me and the work that I do. And so I wouldn't have even written this book, Racism as Zoological Witchcraft, if I only looked at literature and the animal rights movement. Because I think that in order to see the full scope and size of the problem of animal oppression, we can't just assume that the animal rights movement is the only movement tackling this problem. Mm-hmm. And so what I did for my book was I actually purposely looked outside of the animal rights movement to see how other people were talking about this problem. And I was really inspired by conversations in a lot of anti-racist spaces that were talking about this term like zoological racism. They were talking about anti-racism and animals at the same time. And so for me, I would really encourage people to, first of all, stop thinking through movements when we're trying to think about a problem, because we get really limited in doing that. We get stuck in these bubbles. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I would have never even written this book because if I only looked at animal rights stuff, because a lot of the literature that I draw upon in this book come from people who aren't even animal rights activists or who don't even openly write about animals. Mm-hmm. Yet when I was reading what they were writing, it blew my mind, and I saw the links to animals, and that's why I had to write this book, because I'm like, I have to bring these conversations into the same space. And on top of it, I think it's important to note that I don't think one movement alone is going to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. Not at all. When I was reading some stuff, like, I'll get to that later in the interview, like this one guy, James Perkinson, who does nothing with animals, he specifically writes about white supremacy and consumption. When I was reading that, I was like, wow, like, I would bet that most animal rights activists have never even heard of this guy simply because he doesn't call himself a vegan or animal rights activist. And I think that's a huge problem. And so, I definitely think we need more than one movement to do the issue. I mean, I'm sorry, to solve the issue. And lastly, I feel like, and this is something I think maybe a lot of people are noticing, I think the animal rights movement or vegan movement or whatever we want to call it, I think that it's becoming increasingly corporatized. Mm-hmm. And it's becoming, and I'm not talking about like individual activists on the ground who are doing the work, who are doing like sanctuary work and rescuing animals. Those people are some of the most compassionate people I've ever met in my existence. I'm talking about like how we understand what a movement is composed of these like, you know, nonprofits and organizations. I'm seeing a huge issue that it's becoming less and less about animals and getting people to understand animal oppression and more about getting people to just identify as vegan and eat a vegan diet. Mm-hmm. And it's becoming divorced from the issue. And I see that as being really concerning. So that's why I was saying in my book, I think we have to go a little bit outside of the animal rights movement to help animals. And in my last chapter in the book, I purposely say like why the animal rights movement needs to release its grasp over the animal, because mm-hmm. they oftentimes act like they're the only ones who care about this issue, and they aren't.
Right, right, absolutely. The book, I noticed, is pretty heavily critical of the concept of intersectionality as a framework for dismantling systems of oppression, which I found both surprising and thought-provoking. Can you give our listeners an overview of what intersectionality is and why you feel it's not the most effective approach?
Absolutely. So it's worth noting that, you know, intersectionality is literally just one theoretical framework of many. Mm-hmm. And so it's okay if people don't vibe with it. And so initially I did. I learned about intersectionality when I was an undergrad, maybe about 21 years old. And it was, it's a legal framework developed by Kimberly Crenshaw. And it was designed to make black women visible in this legal structure. Because black women, for example, let's say in an employment situation, let's say they were experiencing both racism and sexism uniquely as a black woman. An employer could easily dismiss a black woman's claims by being like, well, how can we be sexist? We have women at our company, and let's say it's all white women. Mm-hmm. Or they're like, well, how can we be racist? We have black people here, and let's say it's all black men. In doing that, we kind of erase the unique situation that black women are in. And so that's why she made this, to kind of make black women visible in a legal structure. Mm-hmm. Now, that term was really, really attractive to social justice movements because it provided language for this feeling we had that, like, we knew a lot of things were happening at one time in terms of oppression, but we didn't know how to articulate it. And so a lot of activists kind of borrowed that term, took it out of its legal context that was supposed to be about black women, and started using intersectional as a synonym for any connection for any oppression. And to a certain extent, I think that's okay. I think it's an attractive, seductive term. I think it makes sense, except that it has a lot of gaps, even in terms of how it's applied towards black women. And the problem is now animal rights activists are taking this framework that was supposed to be about black women that already had a ton of gaps, and now they're just throwing animals into the mix. And not only does that just muddy all the conversations, it dilutes each of these issues as well. And so now today in social justice movements, everyone is talking about like 100 oppressions at one time, and it's confusing. And sometimes it's not accurate. And so in my book, I can't go into all of it right now because it would take like 7 hours. But like, I go into talking about how, you know, intersectionality specifically ignores black men's situations. And I just really don't think it's an appropriate framework to talk about animals. And I offer something different, which is multidimensional theory. So that's basically, you know, in a gist, what intersectionality is and what my problems are with it.
Mm-hmm. So you talk quite a bit in the book about animality and how white supremacy operates by animalizing people of color. What does this mean exactly, and what are some examples of how it manifests?
Right. So I think anti-racist movements are quite fluent in talking about this, that we know that throughout the history of white supremacy, people of color have been considered to be non-human or animal. Right. And so that's essentially what we talk about and we fight about. Now, the problem is in anti-racist movements, we oftentimes talk about animals as a metaphor to talk about our experiences. Right. So I've seen anti-racist protests where people are like, you know, white people need to stop treating us like animals, or they treat us like we're dogs. However, what I do in my theory is I say, well, what does it look like to now actually talk about non-human animals? You know, like, what does it look like when you are animalized, let's say yourself, and now you're going to also talk about animal bodies. So that's what I do in my work. Can you repeat your question? Because I'm losing.
Oh, no. So, yeah, I was just asking you about the concept of animality that you talk about in your book and how white supremacy animalizes people of color. So, you kind of defined what this means.
Sure.
And I was just wondering, what are some examples of how it manifests?
Oh, sure. So there are almost too many.
Yeah.
You can think about, like, police, for example. In the United States, it's a huge problem with police violence. There have been a lot of texts recovered and investigations where, you know, white police officers are referring to black people as monkeys or apes, or even how in U.S. history, black people were put in zoos. You can think about Donald Trump, like, every week, our president, you know, calling people of color animals. Immigrants are animals that are dangerous. He called Omarosa, a former black staff member, a dog. So you see this language of animals being used to weaponize, being weaponized to hurt people of color. And I also think that, you know, in the theory Sil and I talk about, we not only look at the ways in which people of color are animalized, we also look at how animals are racialized. So, yeah, that's what this book touches on as well.
Right, absolutely. One thing that kind of jumped out at me in the book was you talk a fair amount about taxidermy as a symbol of white supremacy. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Totally, yeah. So, in the U.S., I'm going to be careful with how I say this because I don't want to, like, stereotype here. But in the U.S., like, there are particular, like, white subcultures that kind of form their identity or express their white pride through displaying animal corpses. So they'll wear camo, be really into hunting, and you'll see taxidermy or, like, basically, like, petrified animal corpses on walls. Mm-hmm. So for me, I started seeing how taxidermy and animal corpses kind of became this symbol of white supremacy. That taxidermy, in my own personal experience, as well as then reading, you know, scholarship from other people who've been saying this, that taxidermy almost serves as a racialized signpost for white supremacy. And in the U.S., I saw this connection that for certain whites who rely upon animal corpses for their identity, I saw one's desire to dominate nature was coupled with one's desire to denigrate minorities. Mm-hmm. And so in the book, I do, you know, an extensive media analysis, just examining some of my favorite shows and movies, looking at the ways in which even in our popular culture, we kind of draw upon that connection between white supremacy and animal oppression, almost accidentally. I look at this show, Santa Clarita Diet, on Netflix, and they were teasing the neo-Nazi. It's a comedy show. And they purposely make him a hunter, and his house is, like, completely decked out in a ton of animal corpses on the wall and taxidermy. And then they also include a cherry wood cabinet where he has Nazi memorabilia. And so that's kind of like the theme of the episode, that they're kind of poking fun, but also creating this connection between white supremacy and animals. And so in my book, I say that, you know, we recognize, let's say, a swastika as an immediate emotional, like, we have an emotional reaction to a swastika to highlight this white supremacist, like, you know, sign. Whereas I argue that taxidermy kind of similarly has a connection to white supremacy, and similarly, for me at least, has a connotation that there's a white supremacist kind of environment around. So again, I'm saying that lightly because I don't want to offend people, but, like, it's something that we kind of, like, subconsciously know.
Right.
And so that's where I couple or I argue that, you know, animal bodies are racialized in this particular cultural, like, order because they're purposely denigrated and purposely included in this hierarchy where white men are at the top, people of color are seen as being in the middle, kind of subhuman, non-human, and animals are at the bottom. And so it's like, not only are people of color animalized, but animals are also being racialized and are also, what Sil and I argue, experiencing racial violence, which is a really controversial thing to say, taken out of context, but with context, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. So tell me more about the witchcraft element of your theory. How do you see white supremacy as being similar to or even being a form of witchcraft?
Yeah, so this book, by the way, was a lot of fun for me to write because I was just looking through a ton of scholarship, and I had a blast. But it all started after I saw Jordan Peele's popular film Get Out in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
I think that movie, I mean, I'm still, like, shook by that film, and I still watch it. I saw it a million times. And basically, you know, if you haven't seen the movie, there's no way I could possibly summarize it for you because it's that weird. But essentially, white people are harvesting black bodies and black souls and essences. It's a really disturbing film, but it's really good. And after I watched that film, I ran into the scholarship of a scholar named Dr. James Perkinson. And I found an article where he said that European racism is like a form of witchcraft. And he was kind of arguing that historically, think about it, like white societies or white colonizers who would go to black and brown lands, they would go there and completely take over and redefine the practices of what they perceived to be the other. And so it was really common for white people to look at the practices of black and brown people and call it primitive. And oftentimes to call it witchcraft because they didn't understand it. And so Dr. Perkinson is arguing the very act of going to another nation and calling their practices witchcraft is a witchcraft practice in and of itself. Hmm. And so he argues that, you know, white supremacy kind of got its power through Christianity and colonial consumption. And so one of the things that's really disturbing in a lot of the research I did, and I would urge everyone to get the book by Vincent Woodard titled The Delectable Negro. It's a really disturbing book, but it's a history I think animal rights activists should know. It was actually really common for white colonizers to actually literally eat black and brown people.
Wow.
And there's, yeah, disturbing, and I didn't know this. And so, you know, when you think about it, a lot of white people are always looking at black and brown nations and, again, calling their practices primitive or showing how they engage in acts of cannibalism. But it was actually a common practice of colonizers to do that. And I actually argue that in my book that, like, in the same way, like, as we know, rape today is like a tool of war, a horrible, disgusting, sordid tool of war. Consumption was actually a tool of colonization. And in terms of metaphorical consumption, in terms of appropriating and stealing someone's land, their culture, their language, their names, who they are, but also literal consumption, like literally eating people. And so Vincent Woodard has a book where he uses former slave narratives who talked about actually witnessing, you know, white people eating blacks. And so it's a really uncomfortable history, but you when you think about it and you look at that practice, it almost is a white supremacy and racism is almost its own form of witchcraft in that sense. And so he actually also, Dr. Perkinson draws upon Christianity. So I'm going to give a quick story here that he says Christianity, it's so normalized in the West, right? Seen as this like just regular religion. But he says it's actually, if you read the text, it's like it feels like witchcraft. Mm-hmm. And so growing up, I was raised Catholic in a church like my whole life. My father was a music director. He's an organist. I was in a choir my whole life, and one song that we always sang was called Taste and See. And if you're Catholic, I'm not Catholic anymore, but I was raised Catholic. If anyone who's listening is Catholic, they might know that song. And it's played during Mass when it's communion time. And communion is the time when everyone gets and they eat the bread, which is like a wafer. And if you think about it, the bread actually represents Jesus's body.
Mm-hmm.
And then you drink wine, which is supposed to represent Jesus's blood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're just used to saying this like it's a normal day, right? You just go to church on Sunday and like, oh, I'm going to eat the body and blood of Christ. But when you really step back, you're looking at this from a different context. It's like, what the hell is going on? Like that sounds, it sounds like some type of shamanistic practice,
right.
But because white people are doing it, because it's a Western thing, it's seen as like this noble, you know, thing. I'm like, it's weird, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of turns the sorcery of James Perkinson back on white supremacy and Christianity. And so what I do is I take Perkinson and Woodard's work on consumption, colonial consumption, and I bring animals into that conversation by showing how eating animals today is a part of that conversation, is a part of that colonial consumption.
Yes.
So, I know that might sound super weird, but I, you know, yeah.
No, I think it's fascinating. I actually wanted to quickly read one quote from the book that really jumped out at me. This is something that to me seems to encapsulate much of your central thesis. It goes, veganism isn't just about kicking a meat-eating habit and getting some veggies into your diet. It's a powerful rejection of a racist food system and a racist cannibalistic politics that characterizes animals and non-white people as disposable and and consumable. This is why anti-racist theory matters in our efforts to free animals. The goal isn't just to get people to replace chicken with tofu, although that's a great start. The goal is to get the public to understand why animals matter on a political and ethical level. The goal is to reveal how the current power structure relies upon anti-black and anti-animal ideologies to strengthen itself, end quote. So I'm wondering, just going back to this statement of veganism being a powerful rejection of a racist food system and racist cannibalistic politics, can you explain what you mean by cannibalistic in this context?
Yeah, sure. So cannibalism in this context is kind of like a paradox, because on the one hand, people of color aren't fully seen as human. So it's like, well, is it cannibalism, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we're Homo sapien. So it is cannibalism. And so in talking about anti-racism and veganism, and this is, again, why veganism is oftentimes a really confusing vehicle to talk about these politics. It's really confusing, and that's why I hate using the term vegan sometimes, because it's so reductionist. But if we understand that white supremacy, you know, marks certain bodies as non-human or subhuman or animal, not only bolster their own superiority, but to have an excuse to consume them, then we can see how veganism can offer us more than just being anti-speciesist or just fighting factory farming. Like, we're underestimating the power of veganism here. Like, veganism, if we link all these histories together of colonial consumption, the ways in which certain bodies, not only just animal, but people of color were consumed, veganism, with that history, offers us so much more. Mm-hmm. And so, again, it goes back to that history of consumption and taking and metaphorical consumption, that veganism, if we take all that into account, is a rejection of colonial consumption in its totality, and essentially eating others that are deemed racially inferior. So Syl and I make this point again, that animals are racial subjects in this particular white supremacist order, and so we reject eating their bodies. We reject colonial consumption. Again, like I said, just as rape is a tool of war, eating others is a tool of colonialism. It has always been. And that's why I think veganism has the power to do more than what it's doing right now. And I don't think we'll ever reach that potential until we knock down the borders placed around our movements. Because it's frightening to me that animal rights activists are so invested in people, you know, ending meat consumption, but they don't know about this history of other types of consumptions. And if we knock the borders down and put all this literature together, we have a really, really powerful tool. And so this is why, you know, for a lot of people who might be listening, they might be like, wait a minute, Af, are you like comparing oppressions? Are you comparing what black people are going through to what animals are going through? And I always say, no. And first of all, I'll be one of those people to say, I'm not offended by comparisons. I don't think a lot of people have a good justification for being offended by comparisons. I think it's just this thing that we've just accepted that it's insensitive and we shouldn't probe any further. And I always say, when someone has, just because something is sensitive doesn't mean we shouldn't probe it further or talk about it. In fact, we should. However, comparisons, that's not the relationship between what black people are going through and animals. It's not like a comparison. And so in my book, I call it a grammar system. So let me explain this so that people aren't being like, oh my gosh, Af is comparing black people to animals. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing that. So I'm going to ask listeners to like think about this for a second. So imagine that white supremacy, and this is going to be hard to do, but imagine white supremacy is a sentence, right? So you pull out a piece of paper and you write a sentence down with a period point, and that is supposed to represent white supremacy, the sentence itself. I'm arguing in my theory that racial violence is represented by one word in that sentence, and animal violence is represented by another word in that sentence. They make up the building blocks of that entire sentence. You need them both to read the sentence to make sense, right? So racial violence and animal violence are two different words in that white supremacist sentence, and they need to be read together. So it's not about comparing the two words. That doesn't even make sense. It's like comparing the word and the. They're two different words, but they are a part of a grammar system of white supremacy. And so that's why it's difficult to talk about this stuff, because everyone thinks through an intersectional lens where racism is one thing, sexism is one thing, speciesism is one thing. And I don't think like that. I don't think everything is its own individual system that can be compared or intersect. I see everything as being composed of one another. Almost like in my book, I say instead of two dimensions, like a, you know, a piece of paper, a flat piece of paper, I see a cube. I see this as being multidimensional. So it's not about comparing animal violence and racial violence. It's understanding they're composed of one another. Mm-hmm. So I just want to put that out there. And if that's confusing, I promise that in the book it will make complete sense because it's illustrated. And I purposely illustrated it because there's no way for me to actually talk about it without like a PowerPoint. I found that out.
Right.
let me illustrate this. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The illustrations were really cool, actually. It was a great addition. I just wanted to quickly clarify for listeners as well. You've referred to Syl a couple of times. That's your sister, Syl Coe, who was the co-author of your first book, correct?
Yes, yeah. Syl, yes. She co-authored Afroism, my first book, and yeah, so she's very smart.
Awesome, yeah. So now I'm not sure if this is maybe outside your purview as a theorist, but I'm wondering if you have some suggestions for some concrete ways in which activists can apply the theoretical framework you propose to our advocacy. And I'm wondering for white activists in particular, is there an effective and sensitive way in which we can approach these conversations?
Sure. These are good questions. So as a theorist, I don't create practical blueprints for people. And so in the book, I essentially link or try to analogize like being a social theorist to being like, let's say, like a mathematician or someone who does mathematical theory. And I give the example of fractal geometry, which was a mathematical theory, I think, born in the 70s. It was just a theory, and people didn't really care for it. But without this theory, we wouldn't be able to have cell phones today, right? So engineers took fractal geometry and made tiny little antennas, and now they fit into our phones, and we can have these really cool, sleek and cool phones that fit in the pocket. But that wouldn't have happened if it weren't for a theory. So what theorists do is we create ideas that oftentimes seem like elitist or disconnected to like the everyday needs of people, but that's what theory is. It's as necessary as any other form of activism. And what we do is we create ideas that activists in the future, like almost call them like social engineers, social activists, can take these blueprints and create something like tangible with it. That's not what I do. However, what I can offer now to people, or some advice, is to stop thinking through movements. I have found movement logic and movement thinking to be so destructive to understanding an oppression. So destructive. And so it wasn't until I just completely just walked outside of all of these movements and just looked at the literature itself that I started to see like new solutions and ideas. And that's how I was able to write this book. I wouldn't have written this book again if I only stayed in the animal rights movement logic and theory. And so, and in terms of white people, I don't necessarily write just for white people or give them white people specifically advice. And I think that we sometimes underestimate white people's ability to contribute to this conversation. And I say this because there are already a lot of white people doing this work. In fact, I purposely start my new book out with two quotes from two white theorists. One of them is Lindgren Johnson, who wrote one of the best books I have ever read, ever, about anti-racism in animals. And it's called Race Matters, Animal Matters. And she's a white woman. Wow. And she uses black theory to write about animals and race. And that is the future that I see. I see a ton of white people already doing this, but a lot of people just don't know it. And so even James Perkinson is the second quote I use. I purposely start the book out. And he's a white man who has written some of the best theory I have ever read in my existence about white supremacy. And so I think white people are doing work. I think that sometimes in the vegan movement, there becomes this really superficial war between white vegans and black vegans. And for me, I used to be really invested in that. Like years ago, I used to be like, oh man, it's the white vegans. And then I slowly learned over time that it is not the white vegans. It's Eurocentric theory that even black people are subscribed to. And I realized that even when I went into racially homogenous spaces, like let's say only black vegans were around, I still felt the whiteness. I still felt the problem. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's the theory we're using. It's not the melanin level. And so that's why I would argue, let's not think about this through what white people can do, what black people can do, but it's about throwing out or decentering Eurocentric theory and adding in black theory. Because when we add in black theory or decolonial theory, regardless of whatever your race is, beautiful new insights are produced. And that's why I would really urge people to check out Lindgren Johnson and James Perkinson, who are white people, who honestly, I feel like they even write better than I do about race, but I'm black. You know, like they write better than I do about black, you know, anti-racism. And it's impressive. So that's what I would say.
Cool. Yeah, well, we're coming to the end of the interview here. Do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share with us?
Sure. So the book right now is available as an ebook, and it's going to be printed later this month on recycled paper. I really urge people to get the printed because I think it's super cool, and they use this cool effect on the cover that they haven't done before with Afroism. So I'm really excited to hold a copy of it. So just letting everyone know, it should be available later this month. And it's available for pre-order right now.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Af, for joining us on Animal Voices today and sharing these incredible insights with us. It's been wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I had a blast. Thank you, Elise.
And once again, that was writer and decolonial theorist Af Coe. Her new book, Racism as Zoological Witchcraft, A Guide for Getting Out, is available this month. Buy it, read it, it's fantastic. If you'd like to learn more about Af and her work, visit afco.com. That's APHKO.com.
It's the fall fundraising drive here at Vancouver Co-op Radio. Did you know that it costs $50 to create 1 hour of programming? That's over $400,000 per year. This fundraising drive, consider sponsoring 1 hour of your favorite radio show. Head over to cooperadio.org/donate and support real radio by donating today. Or call us at 604-684-8494. That's 604-684-8494. Vancouver Co-op Radio. Your community radio station.
You've been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Tune in for next week's show on Friday, October the 25th. We'll be in the second week of our annual fall member drive that day. And not only will we be video live streaming the show from the studio, but so will Vancouver Co-op Radio on their own Facebook page. And we'll have a very special guest for you to see and listen to that day. We'll be featuring an interview with Jacko, the rescued talking African gray parrot, along with his human guardian, Adrienne Gauthier. Jacko is an amazing avian person, and we'll get to hear his story and see what an incredible bird he is on camera. So once again, that's next Friday, October 25th. Tune in for our fall member drive show with Jacko the parrot and learn about the sentience of all beings and how you can rescue a bird in need, as Adrienne did for Jacko. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Visit our website, animalvoices.org, where you can stream past shows and download them as podcasts. You can also see our show blog there with detailed links and subscribe to us on iTunes. Stay in touch with us on Facebook and Instagram at Animal Voices Vancouver and on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And once again, remember to visit cooperadio.org/donate or call 604-684-8494 to set up your monthly sustaining membership. The Animal Voices team thanks you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now we'll leave you with a song. Here's Lauryn Hill with Black Rage. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Black rage is founded on two-thirds a person. Rapings and beatings and suffering that worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on blatant denial, squeezed economics, subsistence survival, deafening silence and social control. Black rage is founded on wounds in the soul. When the dogs bite, when the bees sting, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I don't fear so bad. Black rage is founded, fed us self-hatred, lies and abuse, while we waited and waited, spiritual treason, this grid and its cages. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on training and dreading, finding your freedom to stop your complaining, poisoning your water while they say it's raining. Oh, man.
is founded on these kinds of things. When the dogs bite, when the beatings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I